will be a show next week. And I guess that's how the whole darn human comedy keeps perpetuating itself down through the generations, westward to wagons, across the sands of time until we... look at me. I'm rambling again. Well, I hope you folks enjoyed yourselves. Catch you all down the trail.
Send me dead flowers to my wedding. And I won't forget to put roses on your grave.
FM and our friends in the community. 100% of your donations go to the general operations at CKUW 95.9 FM. And with a friend's card, your dollars will get you more at
the King Cobb Market Pub at 580 Ellis Avenue, your local arts and craft beer pub. With a rotating selection of local beer, art, music, and Southern-inspired pub eats, your 10% discount on all food and selected taps makes this West End neighborhood pub an ideal place to start, end, or even be your next night out. Be sure to check out their Bella Vista nights every Wednesday for free live music sponsored by CKUW 95.9 FM. Fiercely local.
Join CKUW's community of support by donating $35 during Fun Drive in February to get a friend's card and get access to more deals around Winnipeg.
The following is an encore presentation from CKUW's archives. Join us next week when the regular hosts will be back with a few new episodes of original programming.
Welcome back to Ronnie's Rancid Reviews.
This is Ronnie on the scene at Grant Park Cinema.
Hey, I'm Zach Kreger. I'm the director of Barbarian and the new horror movie Weapon.
Ranking the top five funniest moments in Weapons.
But what did you think of Weapons?
I think it was a really good movie, honestly.
I never understood that.
Peter Chuckling.
What was your favorite?
Weapon. Debuted at 100% on...
We were talking about that earlier.
That's awesome. Yeah.
It's fine. Like, I enjoyed it. I had a good time.
Peter Chuckling. Peter Chuckling. Peter Chuckling. Peter Chuckling.
This is another movie episode. If you don't follow modern movie news, you might not know about the latest big cinematic gem, being Zach Kreger's second venture into horror, Weapons. It's getting a ton of buzz. I believe it premiered at 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. But does it live up to the hype? Spoiler, it does. It absolutely does. But first, I want to talk about his previous film, Barbarian, from 2022.
Critics and audiences are screaming.
This is a movie that follows Tess, who finds herself in a predicament as she's booked an Airbnb that some other guy is staying at, in seemingly a technical mistake with the homeowner's planning. They decide to both crash there, but what follows is a lot more complicated than simply an awkward social situation, where they discover strange things about this Airbnb, such as secret doors, tunnel systems, and various disturbing findings hidden in those tunnels. And just to let you know, I will be spoiling both Barbarian and Weapons throughout these reviews.
So beware.
Barbarian is really great. Thank God Weapons got me to rewatch this because it deserves the bump in score. I initially gave this movie a 7 out of 10 when I first watched it, but it's rise to a new score of 8 out of 10. Speaking of score, I guess I'll start with the audio. This movie sounds great. The score was super well done, a mix between chanting choirs of screams, booming synth lines, and echoing twists that sound like scraping deep in a basement. It's truly an effective combo. The opening few shots were those choirs of horror I mentioned slowly creeping up in the score as our lead Tess pulls up to the new House of Doom, before going silent as we enter through the passenger window. It symbolizes the environment perfectly. Speaking of cool shots through windows, this movie also looks great. In that same opening, we get an incredible shot of Tess stepping through the door straight into the title card. There's really striking visuals all throughout this film, particularly the way they shoot the various underground scenes and the way they contrast the visuals between instances of different characters in different times interacting with a shared environment. This is a big theme I've noticed with Zach Greger's filmmaking. Needless to say, the cinematography from Zach Cooperstein was stellar, and considering how great Weapons looks, it's clear that Greger has a lot of control over his stories and how they play out visually. And also, this movie has great practical gore and set design. It's just very well made. The story is a bit more complicated, and I actually got it this time around. To me, this is a story about roles. It really started clicking with me about two-thirds through the movie, with the help of recalling earlier scenes. One of the first act conversations that Tess had with Keith really stuck out once I started piecing the themes together.
There's always going to be people that project, you know, some kind of dynamic onto us that serves them. It's up to us if we want to play ball or not.
Like I said, I saw this as a story about roles, and particularly how men play God in day-to-day life, with how some men see women as dolls to play house with and manipulate and conform these traditional dynamics onto. Whether it's a damsel in distress, a crazy lady who isn't making any sense, a daughter in need of protection, or a mother meant to care for that daughter. The horror really comes from that foreboding feeling of being trapped in a role, or just being a domino in a long chain or cycle. And moreover, something that continues in Weapons is how men are allowed to do these acts and this idea of common casual apathy in everyday life and how disconnected we've become. And I'll touch more on that later. So that's what stood out to me, this intentional or subconscious trapping of especially women into roles and that sort of objectification and dismissal. At least that's what I thought.
Twisted. No, wait! Shocking. And delightfully unhinged.
In conclusion, this movie sounds great, looks great, and has a very rich subtext. Now for a few negatives. There is a fair share of dumb character decisions. When Tess first discovers the lair, she has a comic relief nope moment, like she's decided to turn back, but then she still goes in there. There's a moment where Justin Long's character AJ falls down while running away from the creature in the cave, and his flashlight starts flickering as he's on the ground, and we see a shot cutting between pitch black and the monster getting closer and closer before she's right in front of him. It's a neat shot, don't get me wrong, but it's insane how close he lets her get before finally trying to run. There's a moment where Tess is escaping through the door and she's bashing it, and she tries like twice and then gives up to try the window. Like, two hits, that's all you got in a life-threatening situation. It's not like a steel door. There's a few other examples, but it just feels like characters don't try that hard and make dumb decisions when it's needed for the plot. It's a little unnatural. There's only a few moments, but the character writing in those scenes kind of brought this down from an 8.5 or 9 to an 8. One last point before I wrap up the review. I hinted at this earlier, but I was really struck by the theme of recontextualizing. I really caught on to it after seeing Weapons. Zach definitely has a recurring cinematic idea he likes to explore, which is returning back to a location or scene or whatever through a new lens or a new character or a new time of day. We get this here with the repeated recontextualizing of the Airbnb. We first see it on a dark, stormy night, but we still don't see its surrounding houses, and most of the horror comes from entering this house itself. We then see it in the morning when Tess wakes up, and we see that it's surrounded by a terrible, decrepit, and worn-down neighborhood, which becomes a whole new source of horror. We then return to it again when AJ travels to the house to liquidate his property, and then out of nowhere, the house that has been only shown in these suspenseful, horror-filled scenes in Act 1 has now been turned into a source of great comedy, as AJ fumbles his way around with a tape measure to squeeze out every square inch of property money. Finally, we see a decade before, just as Detroit is becoming what it became, as everything in the film is recontextualized and we get a full backstory of the house. It's really incredible how much mileage this stinky old house gets. It's really neat, and again, this movie is an 8 out of 10.
Weapons is the best horror movie of the year.
It's unrelenting. It's completely over the top. One of my new favorite movies.
Are you watching?
Now on to the reason I'm talking about Barbarian in the first place, and the real star of this episode, Weapons. Weapons is a film that follows the very intriguing premise of 17 children, all students of the same class, suddenly, at 2:17, leaving their homes, running off, and disappearing into the darkness of the night. We then follow six characters caught up in this mystery as they interact and bump heads with each other, including the teacher of that class, a concerned parent, a cop, a drug addict, the principal of that school, and the only student who didn't disappear.
Matthew, where are you?
A lot of people die in this story. In a lot of really weird ways.
Weapons, rated R.
I'd like to start my review where I started this experience, the theater. This is the first movie this year that I've now seen twice, scratch that, three times in theaters. And I'm very glad I did. This movie is so rewarding in many ways, and one of those ways is being around other people's reactions. This movie has such a versatile tone where some scenes will make people laugh, some will make people scream, and those reactions can be switched around in certain scenes depending on the audience. And I had three quite different crowds. Their first viewing at 4 p.m. was great. People reacted as expected during most scenes, but not as strongly as some would. It was a really great crowd for my first watch to just soak in the movie without distractions, just fully locked in. My second crowd was different. Somehow the audience at 1 p.m. was so much more emotive. There were some real characters. There was a lineup of teens in the row ahead of me who were clearly really into it, and there were some audible shrieks and yelps during certain jump scares. There was this one guy, he was my favorite audience member. He would whisper Jesus Christ loudly after every disturbing scene, and as the movie was rearing to a close and more stuff was happening, there would be a Jesus Christ from that guy like every few minutes, and then he explained, "That was f***ed up," once the credits rolled. Very passionate fellow. This crowd was really perfect for a second viewing, and I would definitely recommend checking this out in theaters more than once if you can. One thing that wasn't great about the second viewing is that every time I go to the theaters, if I decide to get snacks, I always get peanut butter M&Ms, trust me, they're great, and a medium Fanta. It's clear that the soda machine has a varying quality throughout the day, and I think they put less flavor during early and late hours to save money, and my Fanta on the second viewing was pretty flavorless. Add on to that, for a little context, I never go to the bathroom during movies and I rarely ever need to, but somehow I messed up with my bathroom cycle for that day, and my moment where I needed to pee landed right in the middle of the movie. So not only was the drink bad, but it had the gall to make me have to pee. On my third viewing, I opted for no drink, but a bag of those M&Ms. This viewing was definitely the one that had the most barricades. It's become obvious that the people working at these theaters are much more chill during the 1 p.m., 4 p.m. kind of hours, because this 9 p.m. scream time was a little harder. Apparently, this movie is 18A. I watched this movie twice in theaters before, and only now, when I have two friends with me, which means more pressure, am I informed that we actually can't watch the movie if we have no adults present. Thankfully, my dad, who just dropped us off, was interested, so he tagged along and we were able to get in. But there were still issues. There was one guy who was talking for like a quarter of the movie, which I was worried on would go for the whole movie. He left at some point. I accidentally bought mega M&Ms, so there were fewer and they ran out quicker. And I left my water bottle at the theater at the counter, and there were moments of loud food crunching behind me, but once I finally settled in and the distraction ceased, it became another great viewing. My first watch was really great, just hearing the movie out without any distractions. The second viewing was really cementing my feelings and developing my analysis, and my third viewing was a chance to look at the movie on a more technical side, knowing all the behind-the-scenes stuff and looking for little details that you wouldn't notice at first. I also got to hear a new crowd reaction who seemed the most susceptible to the comedy aspects, and I got to hear my friends' thoughts on the movie. Speaking of thoughts, isn't this a review show? On to the actual review. I'm now gonna get into spoilers and stuff, so if you haven't seen Weapons, watch it now. Or whenever you can, because I don't want to spoil this for you. It's a great movie. Are you gone? Did you watch it? Good. Let's begin.
Those kids walked out of those homes, no one pulled them out.
And do you know why?
I mentioned in my review of Barbarian that Zach Cregger clearly likes to put things we're familiar with from earlier scenes into a new context or new light. Weapons takes that to a whole new level. This movie is split into six chapters following a different character in each. And the cool thing about that structure is that those six characters interact a ton, and we get to see previous scenes from a new character's eyes and a whole new type of cinematography. So when I say this movie is really rewarding, this is mainly what I mean. The movie is perfect on multiple viewings because you notice every small detail that's going to be paid off later, and exactly why it's there. It's brilliant. And when I say whole new technique of cinematography, I really mean it. You'll sometimes see a character or event pop up seemingly out of nowhere, and then once we see that same scene through another character's eyes, it'll carry a whole new purpose and a whole new weight. And that weight is often felt because a detail that was previously blurry is now in shot and full focus with so much more cinematic value and suspense. There's a specific shot of a drug addict character being chased by a cop, and through the cop's perspective, it's just in the background, part of a different moment. And then cutting to the addict's perspective, it's one of the most memorable shots in the whole movie, with a bellowing echo as he drops a wrench and a suspenseful Dutch angle, along with some booming score music. So not only does this movie look great, it's consistently purposeful and smart with how everything is demonstrated visually.
Where can I find something awful that isn't, like, startling, but is just arresting? You know, like, you could look at the image with the sound off, you could freeze frame it, and the more you look at it, the worse it would get.
To be continued. To be continued. To be continued.
Hey, Ronnie.
Good reviews.
Fabulous reviews.
This is Ronnie. Make it good.
Suppose Ronnie could have been a
reviewer.
It's Ronnie, all right.
Ronnie reviews.
Fabulous reviews.
And this is the best review we got.
Welcome back to Ronnie's Resident Reviews. Today we're going through the decades in movies. I got four movies and two directors to talk about. Starting in the 70s with Wes Craven's cult classic, The Hills Have Eyes from 1977. And I liked it. This may be because I've only seen so many movies from this decade at all, but I couldn't help but be reminded of other from this era. I thought of Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Deliverance, with this being a 70s horror movie about a gang of sadistic hillbillies. The thing that made those two movies really stand out to me weren't done quite as well in this movie. In Deliverance, the story is compelling due to the main cast of characters' conflicting morals and personality in the face of this danger. And I didn't really care about the main cast in this movie at all. The two blonde kids were pretty bad at acting, especially the dude playing Bobby, and while the old folks were entertaining and the mustache man was pretty incredible, none of them had any personality, except for Beast the dog, genuinely the best character in the movie aside from the mountain people. In Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the characters were pretty bland as well, but the horror was incredible. It's just relentless suspense and terror. The entire dinner sequence is one of the hardest watches. The monster family in The Hills Have Eyes was amazing, and they had some fantastic scenes, like the dad giving his insane speech to the burnt-up old man, but the actual scenes of horror weren't nearly as tense as anything in Texas Chainsaw Massacre. A lot of the jump scares were very goofy and hard to take seriously.
What the hell is this?
Still pretty good, but a little underwhelming in a few ways. Also, this movie had one of the worst endings I've seen in a long time. Doug, the mustache man I mentioned earlier, stones one of the main hillbillies to death off-screen, and then he pulls the stone up and the movie abruptly cuts to red and it just sort of ends. So, 6 out of 10.
They wanted to see something different, but something different saw them first. The Hills Have Eyes.
Next up is Swamp Thing, released 5 years later in 1982. One of Wes Craven's lesser-known movies, this is a comic adaptation of Marvel's Swamp Thing. And it was pretty bad. But bad movies are still sometimes good. Morbius and Madame Web in recent years have been memed on for being so bad, but as movies, they aren't even enjoyably bad for me. However, something like Night Swimmer is very funny to watch for me, an underrated so bad is good movie that came out last year. And I'm happy to say, Swamp Thing lands in the latter category.
He was in the Amazon with my mom when she was researching spiders right before she died.
It's poorly executed sci-fi. The plot is basically that there's a government science outpost in the swamp, and they're working on magic green goo formulas to make plants grow faster and change their properties and stuff. And in this jungle, there's also a team of bad guys who kill people and stuff, and they're mean. And then once they finally crack the code on the goo formula, the people running the science outpost reveal that they're working for the evil killer gang. And the main scientist, played by Ray Wise from Twin Peaks, accidentally pours the goo on himself and gets set on fire and then falls into a swamp and then becomes the Swamp Thing.
This has all the thrills of watching grass grow.
And then after that, it's just a mad dash of the evil German villain trying to track down Swamp Thing and Swamp Thing fighting goons in the swamp. There's no interesting characters, and even as non-characters, they aren't used as vessels for substantial moral dilemmas or interesting concepts, as all great sci-fi pieces convey. All this is just a big dumb monster rumbling around in the jungle, intercut with hilariously bad scene transitions and bad acting slash dialogue, and dialogue mixing. It's just a huge mess, and I absolutely loved it.
What do you want? Watermelons the size of weather balloons? Or tomatoes that'll fetch a stick?
It was an amazing watching experience with my dad and brother. We had a lot of fun picking apart all the wacky, dumb plot points and terrible editing. I will say some of the prosthetics and costumes were pretty fun and decently impressive, but that doesn't make this a good movie. It's a fun movie, but it's still bad. Also, it's crazy that this movie is rated PG. There's two scenes with unneeded 80s nudity and several scenes with guns and violence, including one where Swamp Thing crushes a man's head to kill him. But yeah, that's the movie. 5 out of 10. I would probably give this a more fair rating, like a 3 or a 4, if I was watching this alone, but it really has that so bad it's good quality.
Government agents, scientists, soldiers, master criminals, secret formulas, monsters, and midgets. None of them belong in this swamp. Only one thing does. The Swamp Thing.
On to the next director, Quentin Tarantino, 10 years later with his debut, Reservoir Dogs, in 1992. This is the only movie that I've already seen from my picks today, and I've always been a huge fan of it. One of his best, in my opinion. It revolves around a gang of crooks who plan and execute a botched robbery for jewels. But the movie isn't really about the robbery scene at all. We only really see the drama that surrounds the event. I love how simple this movie is. Just like my actual favorite of his, Hateful Eight, the entire story revolves around a tight group of characters who all don't trust each other and have secrets they're keeping from each other. And just like my favorite movie of all time, The Thing. Probably also why Tarantino wants to turn both Reservoir Dogs and Hateful Eight into stage plays. It's just one of the tropes slash structures that I always fall for. The editing and music were really great. It has some of the best song choices in any movie. And Stephen Wright is the perfect radio host to introduce each segment. I completely forgot that Hooked on a Feeling was in this, and of course the stuck in the middle with you scene is iconic. Speaking of that scene, the ear mutilation is genuinely so gruesome and hard to look at. I forgot how bloody this movie gets. Finally, the characters that make up the well-edited and tight-knit series of events really made this. Of course, Tarantino's writing is brilliant. I don't think the writing is quite as consistently hypnotic as some of the other works he's done, but it's still brilliant. I mean, the color-picking scene is just perfect.
I'm gonna be using aliases on this job. Mr. White, Mr. Blonde, Mr. Blue, Mr. Orange, Mr. Pink.
Why am I Mr. Pink?
Because you're a fa-
The acting is great from the whole cast, mostly. Harvey Keitel is probably the best performance in the whole film. He has such a powerful presence and understanding of his character. Lawrence Tierney and Michael Madsen were also very entertaining, but my favorite character to watch was probably Steve Buscemi's Mr. Pink. There's just something so compelling about him, even though his character isn't the most complex. And the reason I said mostly is that I don't really like Tim Roth in this movie. He plays Mr. Orange, who is arguably the second main character in the whole movie, and he has a huge vignette all to himself. He plays one of the crooks who turns out to be an undercover cop, and we get to see his entire backstory relating to this robbery. And his accent is honestly just so atrocious and distracting, and it kind of took away from those stretches of scenes. He just has such a goofy and not believable performance.
I'm gonna die, I know it!
But that's my one main issue. I love everything else about this movie. I love how literally every character dies except for Mr. Pink. This is a 9 out of 10 for me. Huge fan.
The Reservoir Dogs.
Hey, Joe, tell me to shoot this guy.
Next up, from 15 years later in 2007, Quentin Tarantino made Death Proof, and I finally got around to watching it, and I have to say, he may be misproof in terms of his catalog. This movie is split into two parts, both revolving around a group of girls who are stalked by stuntman Mike, played by Kurt Russell, who has a powerful muscle car that he uses as his murder tool. And I loved it. Basically just Tarantino working his screenwriting and stylistic charm in an entirely new world and structure. I really loved the dialogue and most of the character writing. I think sometimes the women's lines felt obviously written by a man, which of course they were. Also, he seriously just can't control his goddamn foot fetish. Since this has the highest concentration of female characters, he really went off the rails with the foot stuff in this movie.
Quentin has separated more women from their shoes than the TSA.
But I mostly really enjoy the character banter. The editing was very well done. This movie is fully in the style of a 70s slasher, so this whole episode kind of goes full circle. And this was made for a project called Grindhouse with a similar theme. The camera is very grainy and there are several choppy cuts that give the vibe that the tape has been worn down, and there's a few camera and color changes. There was maybe one cut that was a little too wacky and jarring for me, but the strange old dusty feel of the edit and the camera shifts all worked very well for me, especially the editing in the last minute. Probably one of the best endings I've ever witnessed. As opposed to the abrupt ending of Hills Have Eyes, the abrupt ending of this movie feels very intentional and stylistic and hilarious. Also, the music choices and music editing were really perfect for the era and style he was drawing inspiration from. The long, windy silences were so perfect for the 70s slasher homage, and it made the few needle drops hit so much harder. Particularly the music at the last chase scene and the music during Pam's scene.
Which way are you going? Left or right?
Right.
That's too bad.
I love the horror aspect. Kurt Russell was incredible in this movie. His menacing aura in the first half, contrast with his babyish yelping at the end, was perfect. And all the gore and kills, although there isn't much, were pretty great and fun. I really love this movie. Underrated. I would give it an 8 out of 10.
Quentin Tarantino's Death Proof.
This car is 100% death proof.
That's all the movies I have this week. I know the two Wes Craven movies had much lower ratings than the two Tarantino movies, but don't paint me as a Wes hater. I really adore both Scream and Nightmare on Elm Street, but I just didn't connect too much with the other two. But yeah, I guess the 90s are the best era movies based on the small sample size. If you want more info on the show, check out Review Ronnie on Instagram. And before I let you listeners go, it's time for Ronnie's Joke of the Week. Hey, it was pretty unwise of Ray Wise to be in the Swamp Thing movie, am I right? I really couldn't come up with anything this week. See you next time on Ronnie's Rabid Reviews.
Hey, Ronnie.
Good reviews?
Fabulous reviews.
This is Ronnie. Make it good.
I suppose Ronnie could have been a
reviewer.
It's Ronnie, all right.
Ronnie.
Reviews.
Fabulous reviews.
And this is the best review we got.
You are tuned to CKUW 95.9 FM, Winnipeg Radio, made possible by generous listener support.
Night.
Tune in every Tuesday night starting at midnight to 3 o'clock in the morning to Night Danger Radio on CKUW.
Homelessness is a lot like musical chairs. Except not with chairs.
When the music stops, more than a quarter of a million Canadians, many of them children, don't have a home.
But if we act right now with urgency, we can fix it.
Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions. Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca.
Help the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness.
Mm-hmm.